I guess I'm on. So I'll make a couple of announcements. This coming Monday, Maria Katera, also from Ann Arbor, is coming in. She's with the American Studies and Women's Studies programs at the University of Michigan. She'll be talking about Working for Justice, Legacies of Latina Activism in Southeastern Michigan, which is based on a number of oral histories that she's done with women in Southeastern Michigan, which would be great. So I'll send that around along with, hard to believe that we're 1 month away from the end of spring semester and the end of the brown bags for the year. We have two in April. And then I'm already beginning to talk about next fall. And hopefully we'll have some musical brown bags. We'll have a variety of other things. So I'll just throw these. Bill, I'll let you simply be my Mr. Distribution Artist if you would do that. And I'm very happy to have Rebecca Munich here today. Rebecca is a director at the Ecology Center, or just a worker bee?
Right? I'm a program director.
Program director at the Ecology Center in Ann Arbor, which was, I believe, one of the first big ecology centers, if I remember rightly, in the United States when it was set up. And she's a doctoral student in the Department of Anthropology here, really working on something that's absolutely central here at Our Daily Work, Our Daily Lives, which is really looking at workers who normally, agriculture workers by their very nature, not only here in the United States, but globally, are often really the leading edge of the precariat because of the fact that they work harvesting food at times that they cannot themselves eat. They are working on farms that often are the greatest example of actual land inequality anywhere in the world. And so it's an interesting issue because the fact that it's created the fair trade movement, which we're going to find out a little bit about today. Rebecca works on Brazilian coffee workers, as we'll find out today. And it's great that she was able to come up and join us here at Our Daily Work, Our Daily Lives. So her topic today is labor, livelihoods, and Brazilian black gold, navigating fair trade, coffee quality, and environmental standards. So please help me in welcoming Rebecca Munich to our podium today. Thanks for coming.
Thank you. Thanks for having me. So as John said, I am the Environmental Health Campaign Director at a nonprofit called the Ecology Center over in Ann Arbor and a PhD student here at the same time. A little bit more about myself and my connection to fair trade and environmental work. I have been involved in environmental and social justice work as an activist for about 15 years and have been, you know, in the academic sphere for a little bit less than that. Working on my master's and then my PhD here in the anthropology program. And I met John through some work that, or through a scholarship program for UAW, either children of UAW members or UAW members, and our shop, the Ecology Center, is organized by the UAW. I was the union steward for about 3 years there. Recently stepped down and handed that over to another person. So the issues about labor and people's livelihood strategies have always been something that's very important to me, as well as the connection between our environment and how that impacts human health and the societies that we live in. So I came here to study anthropology and was really interested in coffee, wasn't sure where I was going to end up in the world to do that work. Had done work as a fair trade activist in my undergrad and continued on with that in grad school. I am currently the co-chairwoman of a board of a fair trade organization in Chelsea, Michigan, in Southeast Michigan, and we earlier this year, at the very beginning, the very end of last year, became the first fair trade town, Chelsea, Michigan, did in the United States, or in Michigan, not in the United States. So it's something that, as I have both the activist and academic side here, so it's fun to talk about my research and the work that I do and the farmers that I worked with. I have been doing this research for quite some time. My first field visit was in 2006, and I'll talk a little bit about my field site in the upcoming slides. And I've done research with the coffee farmers and fair trade activists both in Brazil, and in the United States. So looking at sort of the whole spectrum there for my dissertation. But today I'm really going to focus on one of the chapters that looks at the livelihood strategies that the farmers have to utilize to keep their families afloat. And in fact, talk a little bit about how fair trade coffee production and organic coffee production in itself, unfortunately, isn't enough, although it definitely is better than alternatives. So I want to go into some of those details. So in April 2011, a documentary film called After the Harvest, which I'll show a quick clip of in a moment, was debuted at the 2011 Specialty Coffee Association of America Expo in Houston, Texas. And this is an expo where specialty coffee growers, farmers, and businesses, buyers, and intermediaries come to from all over the world to really learn like what's new in coffee, how can they improve their production, to make really important contacts. And I've gone to this a couple of times and served as a translator for the cooperative that I worked with. And the presidents there who don't really speak a lot of English, and most people don't speak Portuguese, even though a lot of the coffee buyers will speak Spanish, and so they kind of muddle through, but there's understandably some misunderstandings with the language barrier there. So in 2011, After the Harvest was debuted there, it was a project supported by various NGO partners and Green Mountain Coffee Roasters, now Keurig Green Mountain, which is the largest purchaser of fair trade coffee in the world. The film shed a lot of light on the problem of food insecurity in the coffee lands and the fact that farming families in many parts of the world face lean months where they actually don't have enough food for their families despite the premiums that they're earning on their coffee for being organic or fair trade, for example. So the film might have been a revelation to some of the people in the audience, but it certainly wasn't to the folks who were producers in the audience, the farmers there, and the cooperative presidents. So After the Harvest offers this popular depiction of food insecurity, which is complementing a growing body of academic literature on the subject that has documented either chronic or seasonal food insecurity and hunger among coffee producers in coffee-selling countries. So I'm just going to show just like a 3-minute clip of the movie here, if it works out. Oops, wrong button.
Throughout the world, over 25 million people earn their living by growing coffee. The vast majority of these farmers are paid only once a year after they have delivered their coffee. For the rest of the year, farmers and their families are often forced to stretch their money and their food supply until the next year's harvest. The result is seasonal hunger, an experience so common that from Mexico to South America, it has its own name, Los Meses Flacos, the thin months.
I had thought earnings from coffee, particularly certified coffees, would be enough to put, you know, children through school, would be enough to put food on the table all year long, and that provided farmers with a reasonable quality of life. But what I learned was that's not true. That certified coffees are helping, there's no doubt in my mind, they are helping. But the fact is that coffee by itself is just not enough for small scale farmers. It's just not providing enough income for them to advance. It's barely enabling them to survive.
One of the key strategies in fighting hunger is helping coffee farmers return to a more diversified farm. Coffee cooperatives, nonprofits, and the specialty coffee industry are supporting pilot projects that teach fruit and vegetable production, food preservation techniques, and how to market what they produce locally as an additional source of income.
El proyecto significa primero que es una seguridad alimentaria, que el mismo nombre lo dice, que es una seguridad alimentaria.
The whole specialty coffee industry is focused on quality. And I think companies need to step back and take a look at the basis of quality. Families who are growing specialty coffee, particularly small-scale farmers, will invest in quality only after they're able to feed their own families. They're not going to feed their coffee plants before they feed their families. So this is the challenge. You know, we have an industry that's very focused on sustainability, And yet here is something that is just so fundamental to life and also to quality coffee that it really needs to be dealt with on an industry-wide scale.
Lo que quiero que lo mismo ejemplo que yo haga, que lo hagan las mujeres para que salgamos todos adelante. Yo sé que con un conjunto de personas, de familias, logramos que la escasez de vaca flaca.
If your business partner in any business was starving, was facing periods of chronic malnutrition or illness, would you not be interested in addressing that? So once we know, once we see these hidden causes, I think it's incumbent upon us to do something about it if we're calling ourselves partners. Working with them, providing what they need, really makes a difference in the long run. It's what distinguishes real developmental impact from charity.
Okay. Oops. Don't worry, I'm not too far behind. So, fair trade is one of the systems that I'll focus on today, as well as organic coffee production. And I think what the film shows is it's a nice
Cuando yo comencé a hacer los cafés, fue un tiempo que absolutamente fue un tiempo difícil. Sufríamos porque mi familia que tenía aguantábamos hambre.
All right. There we go. So fair trade is a third-party certification and labeling program that has been promoted in a lot of places as a simple solution to poverty among small-scale farmers. And it's promoted as that this poverty is as a result of government's limited ability to regulate markets, subsidize agriculture, and provide social services for folks, for farmers and other folks in their country. So fair trade provides farmers with a minimum price per pound of coffee, premiums for social development, such as for education and healthcare, and access to credit, including pre-financing for coffee production, which is incredibly important. In return, there are some requirements like equitable labor practices, no child labor, equal pay and recognition for women, freedom of association and democratic decision-making within cooperatives, and adherence to a number of environmental standards. So, fair trade as an alternative development paradigm is consistent with free market objectives to promote trade-based rather than aid-based development strategies. However, a number of scholars and activists have been skeptical of fair trade's ability in and of itself or alone to leverage the free market to bring about economic development for small-scale farmers. So I want to talk a little bit about my research site. Coop Farm is a cooperative in Minas Gerais, the state of Minas Gerais, Brazil. And it's located in the municipality of Poço Fundo, which is a small town around, it was about 17,000 people when I did the bulk of my field work there. And so in this paper, I'm going to explore how the farmers at Coop Farm, who are both dual certified fair trade and organic and have some other certifications like a Minas Grown certification, which is sort of an origin-based one, employ various livelihood strategies in addition to producing very large quantities, relatively, of high-quality dual certified coffee. And they need all of these strategies to sustain their families. So this paper draws on 10 months of ethnographic research in Sul de Minas, region of Minas Gerais, and as I said, the municipality of Poço Fundo. Coop Farm is one of two fair trade certified coffee cooperatives in Poço Fundo. It is one of, I believe, around 14 fair trade certified cooperatives and one plantation that is certified fair trade now in Brazil. Poço Fundo, along with its neighboring districts of Machado and Campestre, is said to produce some of the best quality coffee in Brazil. The reasons for this are the varying altitudes from 800 to 1,300 meters, so good coffee is grown at higher altitudes. This is excellent for growing Arabica coffee. And the wonderful Tahuasa soils. These are, I don't know if you can really see them. Do I have a... There's a little bit there. You can see the soils are sort of red, and so they're very mineral rich and full of nutrients there. 44.5% of Pozo Fudenses lived in the rural parts of the district. Agriculture is the most important economic activity in the municipality, with 62% of the population engaged in agriculture activity, which means some people live in the city but work in agriculture, obviously. Of the 1,698 farms in the district, 81% were considered to be small family farms, not large plantations. So when you come up to Pozo Fundo from the lowlands where you might catch the bus from São Paulo, the big city, you sort of have a study in Brazilian agricultural history. You rise out of seas of sugarcane production, and you see the sort of the historical production of sugar in Brazil, and I won't go into all the details here, it's another presentation. But from that, you then see these large sugar plantations start to turn into ginormous coffee plantations. And Fazenda Ipanema is one of the largest coffee plantations in the world, and that's just about 20 minutes outside of Pozo Fundo. And then you start to go up in elevation, you start seeing coffee plantations or production become smaller. And you start seeing the banana trees and the sugar cane and the trees making smaller quadrants of coffee production. The area here used to be Mata Atlantica rainforest, which has largely been denuded of native plants, and now coffee dominates the landscape. So the coffee farms surrounding Pozo Fundo, as I mentioned, are small and delineated by the bamboo, the sugarcane, the bananas. This is particularly important in something like organic agriculture, where they actually can prevent pesticide drift if your neighboring coffee plantation uses pesticides, for example. So small pink, green, and blue houses dot the landscape, and kitchen gardens are also visible alongside many of the homes. The kitchen gardens sort of offer just a hint of the diverse livelihood strategies that the farmers that I worked with at Co-op Farm engage to sustain their families. So it's kind of hard to see the timeline. My apologies. COFAM was first established as an agricultural association in 1998 by a group of folks in the area who were farmers and who didn't feel like they fit in with the agricultural union because they weren't farm workers. They owned land, small pieces of land. So they started an association which later became a cooperative so that they actually could sell their coffee and export their coffee. And the association started in 1989. It received fair trade certification from Max Havelaar first in 1997, and then fair trade labeling organization certification in 2000. And it wasn't really until 2000 with the FLO, fair trade labeling organization certification, that the farmers were able to export coffee that they could sell at the fair trade price. In 2004, the cooperative was established. And today, they range every year is a little bit different, but between, in the course of my research, between 250 to 350 farmers in the cooperative, farming families, I should say. So the explorations of fair trade and organic coffee have often sort of excluded a large amount of domestic work that is done in the home and the community to sustain the family and the community. And as a result, the existing studies do not account for a tremendous amount of work that is done primarily by women in coffee farming communities. Martha Ward explains how many types of labor that women do is invisible, in fact. The four types of invisible labor Ward discusses are informal sector work, reproductive work, the work of status enhancement, and the work of morale, caring, repairing, and integration. And in fact, these are important things to consider and things that I considered in my research in thinking very holistically about the labor that is being done in this community and who is doing it. Because all these types of work are invisible, they're often not given recognition, and women may face discrimination, their worth is not collectively and publicly accounted for, as a result. So feminist political economist Marilyn Waring has written extensively on women's labor and the missed opportunities to truly account for the economic productivity if women actually counted in our economic systems. Drawing on the research of these feminist scholars, my exploration of livelihood strategies among the farming families at Co-op Farm includes invisible domestic labor, largely done by women, including cooking and food processing, housekeeping, child and elder care, and community and relationship building activities. So the number one income-generating activity for farmers at Co-op Farm is the production of high-quality, organic, and fair trade certified coffee. To produce a cup of high-quality, dual-certified coffee at Co-op Farm, you need a lot of labor. A mountain of inputs, like fertilizers, and an access to appropriate technology. Coffee farmers whose coffee is not up to the quality exigencies of the specialty coffee market cannot access the export market and obtain the premium prices that are associated with fair trade and organic certification. The environmental and quality standards that are necessary to reach the fair trade and organic markets and the selling of coffee for export in general has changed the amount, style, manner, and type of labor that both men and women do on the farm, on the drying patio where they dry the coffee, and within the cooperative structure itself. Both women and men have to do more work to produce export quality coffee. So coffee, like many other crops, is planted in the rainy season in Poço Fundo from December to March. Men are largely responsible for planting new coffee bushes, pruning existing plants, fertilizing and weeding in the groves. The fertilization of coffee bushes and weeding takes more time than in the past because of fair trade and organics environmental standards. Under these two certification systems, farmers cannot use herbicides, so weeds must be removed by hand or mechanically. Men weed or till between the coffee rows three to five times per year, depending on the rainfall. If there's more rainfall, there's more weeds, to keep the weeds from stealing nutrients and water from the coffee. Manually or mechanically weeding takes longer than the application of herbicides, and so it's also much more physically demanding work. The fertilizing organic coffee in particular is also very demanding. The organic farmers actively fertilize their coffee groves with compost. The husks of dried coffee cherries there, this is compost. And then manure and castor seeds are mamona. And leguminous plants as well are also planted with the crops. These are all permitted under organic certification, and there are also organic fertilizers that you can buy that are certified. So according to Brazilian soil scientists, coffee needs approximately 80 tons of organic material per hectare per year to be properly fertilized. The cooperative's former president, Marcelo Gonçalves, explained that it takes him 8 days to bag, move, and spread the compost that he uses on his 2.4 hectares. Marcelo is applying fertilizer and weeding in his coffee grow 5 to 6 days a week for 7 months, and then harvesting 6 days a week for 4 months, as well as then running a cooperative. Harvesting coffee is done over a period of 4 months from mid-May to mid-September. It's very labor-intensive for both men and women. So men and women begin harvesting the coffee cherries together, but eventually women come out of the fields typically to work on the drying patios, the tejeros, because they have to spend so much time there. Families spend 12 hours a day, 6 to 7 days a week in the coffee field, harvesting the cherries, and then drying the cherries on the tejeros. I don't have a picture of a tejero. Oh, well, I guess I do there. You can hardly see it, though. Sorry. So many farmers take extra time to do some level of selective harvesting by hand because they earn more money for higher quality coffee. Some will only harvest certain rows or bushes that are mostly full of mature cherries. Others decide bush by bush. And still others will only harvest the mature cherries from one bush and wait for others to mature and go back to harvest them later. Certain technologies, like this dejicadera, de café is a little device with these little plastic hands that vibrate and cause the ripe coffee cherries to fall from the bush and are collected in a tarp underneath, where they can then be sort of winnowed here, and you can winnow out leaves and sticks and different things like that before they go to the tejero to dry out. Not all farmers, I'll call it the drying patio, not all farmers have access to these machines. They're actually quite expensive, but they do save a lot of time for those farmers that can get them. Oh, I do have pictures of the tejero. So during the coffee harvest, women spend many hours on the drying patios to ensure the coffee dries evenly. 90% of Arabica coffee is dried in cherry form. So that's with the fruit of the coffee on it. This is a process called natural processing. It's only done in a few other places like Ethiopia, I think some Sumatran coffee. Most coffee is wet or semi-washed, in like Mexico and Nicaragua and other coffee-producing areas. So farmers explain that it takes 20 to 60 days of drying the coffee on the coffee drying patios to reach the optimal dryness level of 12% moisture. At Coffee Farm, women are working more hours per day, more days per year, to turn the cherries than they ever have. After the harvest is done, the men bring the cherries to the patio to dry. Women turn the coffee every hour on the hour so it dries evenly. They start at as early as 7 a.m., pile it up around 4 p.m. every day, and in the evenings, they're swept into large rows or piles so that they can retain the heat that they gain from the sun over the day and sometimes covered with tarps. During the harvest, women farmers like Rosangela have to balance her regular work, domestic work like gardening, beekeeping, caretaking activities with this additional workload of the drying patio. It's a challenge to accomplish everything during the harvest. Rosangela explains her routine during the coffee harvest and how she tries to balance the extra hours spent on the drying patio with her normal routine. When we have coffee on the patio, I still have to do all this and mix the coffee. I sort the coffee, mix the coffee, clean the bathroom, mix the coffee. My work doesn't stop. I can't put things into their place. Nothing gets in its place when we have coffee on the drying patio. Women's time on the drying patio mixing the coffee is absolutely critical for the production of high-quality export coffee. In the past, many farmers used to leave their coffee in the field, just in between the rows of the plants, in bags or in the rows. However, this lowers the quality because it causes the coffee cherry to ferment, sometimes within a matter of hours. And the farming families have benefited from coffee education programs that the cooperative has brought in and that have been subsidized by fair trade organizations or governmental organizations in Brazil. Women in the cooperative's women's group, they have a women's group, have canceled their monthly meetings each year for the first few months of harvest time because of all the extra work. They explained that when they were pregnant or had very small children, their coffee quality really suffered because if there wasn't a relative who could care for the child or who could help out on the patio during that time. So depending on the weather, the drying process for one batch of coffee takes anywhere from 20 to 60 days. The more rain you have, which is happening more and more often because of changes in the climate, means that it takes a lot longer for the coffee to dry. During the 2009 harvest, farmers complained that the excess rain was increasing the time that they needed and affecting the quality as well, causing more fermentation. So I now want to talk a little bit about some other livelihood strategies outside of coffee, if I can get this to adjust. So this is a list of some of the subsistence farming activities that are there, the things they produce. So the farming families within Kofam, unlike the ones that we saw in the video, actually, after the harvest video, are food secure, meaning that they have consistent access to sufficient, safe, and nutritious food to meet their dietary needs and food preferences for an active and healthy life. That's the World Food Summit Plan of Action quote from 1996. So farmers procured food by purchasing it from local markets and the supermarket through trade or barter, by growing, raising, and processing it themselves, And most farming families produced a significant amount of their own food, ranging between 60 and 95%, and only bought a few staples like flour, sugar, salt, oil, and occasionally rice. Some farmers actually produced rice. All of the farmers I met grew staple food, including corn and beans and manioc, and as I mentioned, a few rice. And they also grow a diverse amount of fruits and vegetables and raise a number of things like chickens for eggs or for meat, keep pigs. Some have fish ponds where they raise tilapia and other fish. Most farming families processed food and medicinal products as well. Oops, that's not the right slide, but we're almost there. Growing and producing these foods and medicinal products like propolis, which is a medicinal product that comes from production of bees, can take a considerable amount of time for both men and women on the farms. So some farming families actually are able to then sell products like honey. This is honey, this is coffee, milk, and even tobacco. Poso Fundo historically was a big tobacco producing region, and so there are still farmers that are producing tobacco. Those that have organic certification are not supposed to produce tobacco. Those that are just fair trade, there's no conflict there. So some of them will keep tobacco production in one spouse's name and not the other's, and there are ways that people get around this to produce extra money. So some families, for example, Luis Carlos and Josangelo, grow organic products like tomatoes, watermelons, and lettuce. They keep the bees for honey and propolis and sell these products from their home and also from an organic farmer's market in Pozo Alegre, a neighboring town. Farmers also sold milk or eggs locally, and they take coffee that is not export quality to the agricultural institute nearby to have it roasted and ground. Some of these farmers grow and, as I said, process tobacco. Women tend to care for the livestock, like chicken and pigs, while men tend to care for livestock like dairy cows and cattle. Women tend to care for kitchen gardens, and both men and women harvested horticultural products from their farms for sustenance. Often women will do this on the kitchen garden side of things, men will do it when they intercrop their coffee with other horticultural products. So men tended to harvest sugarcane, which is not shown here, to process for a product called rapadura, which is like a kind of like a brown sugar or a molasses product, but it's in a hard block form. And occasionally things like an alcohol called cachaça. Some folks call it Brazilian rum. Women make processed foods like sweets and cakes and cheeses that they sometimes can sell or trade with other families. So I want to talk again about some of that invisible work that I alluded to before. So work in the home. So in the home, women's domestic activities contribute significantly to the emotional and the financial well-being of the family. In the countryside, women do an incredible amount of work in and around the home. They're responsible for taking care of children, taking care of elders, cooking from scratch. They don't use processed foods like many of the folks who live in the city do, cleaning and doing laundry, mostly by hand, caring for the kitchen garden, preserving food for the season, caring for the small animals, chicken and pigs, turning the coffee on the drying patios, and cooking and preparing for religious festivals that are very important and other events in their communities. Unlike women in the city, most farmers do not have hired domestic help or empregadas for cooking, cleaning, and childcare, whereas even people who are sort of lower middle class in the cities often do have domestic help. At Cofam, some of the families interviewed had a spouse or an adult child who also works outside of the home or is attending college. Farmers who work outside of the home tend to do so because they can't earn enough money from coffee production alone or other on-farm activities like selling products. Or sometimes they just simply have another professional interest or career interest. Farming families who need to work outside of the farm for financial reasons tend to have an unmet financial need because of the lack of access to a sufficient amount of land to grow coffee. For example, Leonardo engages in several off-farm activities to meet his family's cash needs because he only has 1 hectare of land. This is Leo here. He works at doing cooperative maintenance and in the Rebeneficio, which is the the processing area where they actually do the sorting for quality and things like that. And that's a picture from the Hibeneficio. And he also works for other farmers on other farms during the harvest, and occasionally will do some construction work for folks. So he has a very diverse sort of livelihood, supplemental livelihood there. His farm is so small that he has to do all this work. In addition to his work off of the farm, his wife, Helenisi, also works from time to time as a domestic worker, as an empregada, for other families. So several other women mentioned that they have also worked as empregadas to make ends meet occasionally. A number of farming families have adult children who are working outside of the farm. And for example, at the time of my research, two of the secretaries of the cooperative and association were the daughters of farmers in the cooperative. So I think I want to pause here and wrap up with a few pieces of closing pieces to think about, and hopefully to spur some questions and discussion. So I think that what we see here is the amount of work that has to be done, where folks are working, you know, 7 days a week, really without much of a break. They don't have excess time to go on vacations and things like that, which we think, you know, we would love to do or are able to do. On the other hand, so the question I am wrestling with here is, what's the social sustainability of this production system, where you can't make enough income from your day job, and so you have in many cases a double burden of work or a triple burden of work for men and women on the farms. You have the coffee quality requirements, and the requirements to meet organic standards are requiring additional work in the harvest, in fertilizing coffee, in weeding, and things like that. And so the amount that we are paying for coffee doesn't necessarily actually account for all of this additional work, in addition to everything that has to be done to sustain the family. So all of those agricultural activities that, you know, mean that you can produce 60 to 91% of the food for your family and so on. Yeah. That's a great question. So Brazil has universal health care, to start there, and it is largely still a Catholic country. So contraception is available, but many people practice in different ways. There weren't very many families with lots of children anymore. I didn't study this. You know, it wasn't something I went in, but from my own observations, you know, people would talk about, the adults would be like, I grew up, I had 8 brothers and sisters, and then they have 2 kids. So I think some of that planning it's happening through education. People are becoming more, women in particular, are better educated going through school, so the children of the farmers have more education. I don't know. That's an excellent question. I'll have to look into that. Yeah, certainly. I know that certain things are probably covered, like vasectomies and getting your tube tied, but things along the lines of the pill, that's a good question that I don't know. But that's certainly something that, you know, when you're, the more children you have, there's this tension, right, between there's more hands to do the work, but there's also more mouths to feed, and particularly at those precarious times like the harvest, when you have to spend so much time on the drying patio, if you're a woman, to make sure the coffee, you can sell it at that top price, which they do. These farmers, I should mention, earn a premium that's much higher than many of their fellow farmers in other countries, and so that has helped them, but it's still not enough to just have the coffee production and not everything else.
You know,
yeah.
What I was thinking is the demographic that we're doing now is that as people give up, or have more and more in the past, gave up in despair because they could not feed themselves, not this is because feeding the population of large cities, mm-hmm. which is typical. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
know,
right.
Because if the population as a whole, I mean, some of those who were giving up are maybe just disappearing.
A lot of people are. In fact, one of the things that came out in my research was, so a lot of the young people are moving. Minas has a huge immigration or out-migration issue, where folks are moving to the cities, the bigger cities like Rio and São Paulo, but also to the United States. This is something that was so surprising to me, that there's a lot of different enclaves in New Jersey and some other areas on the eastern seaboard that people from this town, like there were, I believe, this is a town of 17,000 people in 2009 when I did the bulk of my research, and 1,500 had lived in the United States. They're not coming in legally, they're coming in illegally. And then they're finding work, and they have these networks, and then they usually want to come back, but they go back and forth many times. And this is something that I had never thought about. I knew about the issues with people moving from the rural areas to the cities within Brazil. That I knew about. And every time you go into one of the big cities, and I speak with obviously an American accent on my Portuguese, but also a Minas accent, and people are like, "Where did you learn Portuguese?" And they're like, "Well, we're from Minas too," and so you're always meeting folks there, and they talk about where they grew up, and it was rural, and then they moved into the bigger cities because they just couldn't make a living, and it's so much work. And I think the quote here, this is from Luis Carlos, that life is hard, but it's very good, is something that you hear from the farmers who really want to stick with this. Is it's really hard, but they love working the land. They love, you know, being close to nature. Many of the farmers that are in this cooperative are environmentalists, and they would say that, that they care about what impact they have on the environment. It's quite often rooted in their Christian faith. The cooperative was the association, I should say, before the cooperative started, was started with the help of a Catholic priest, who got the farmers working and thinking in this area, and that was part of the Comissão Rural, the Rural Pastoral Commission, which came through the Catholic Church in Brazil.
Is this area one of those in Brazil that's been suffering drought?
No, Minas in particular hasn't been. The deforestation that happened, the Mata Atlântica, happened centuries ago. So it's been denuded for quite some time. Yeah. Yeah. A lot of the
recent deforestation.
Right. Absolutely. And what I'm saying is that this is historical. It's been deforested. In this area, it's been centuries. And so they don't have those issues. And there's other, local climatic issues that probably are causing that. But yeah, there's horrible droughts in São Paulo, and then in some other areas as well. São Paulo is running out of water in the city, and they don't have a solution.
Now, Rebecca, are there other things that you want to conclude with before we open it for more questions, or are you?
No, I think this is good. It's my last slide. I'm happy to go back and answer questions. I skip through different things more quickly than others, so. That's all right.
Well, let me just hit you with one that you, because you're raising this issue. Here in America, we've had a huge issue with rural kids and working class kids generally, whose families made sure that they went to school and then to college.
Yeah.
And naturally that takes them out of the flow of production. What is this next generation that is going to college? Obviously they're moving to the cities. Is it now kind of return payments from those kids that's the difference on sustainability or not on sustainability in relation to the household income? Mm-hmm. And also, how does school, do rural schools in this area work with coffee production in terms mm-hmm. of the timing of classes mm-hmm. or how exactly do mm-hmm. during harvest season do they mm-hmm. they really actually have school or are mm-hmm. the kids working the farms?
Mm-hmm. great questions. There isn't a, for the rural, the folks at CoFAM at least that I worked with, there isn't really a remittance structure with children who've gone to college and then work in the cities. The families see that as them improving their lives. Now there is in the cities, there's this remittance thing happening when, let's say, a husband goes to the United States or to the city and sends money back. But that's not happening in sort of the with the generational thing. It's between, you know, adult children and their parents. So it's really, farmers are encouraging, there's this tension. They want their children to take the farm and to work the farm, but they don't want them to have to do it, you know, to have to do it to survive. They would rather them be able to do it on the side and hire someone during the harvest to pick the coffee. So they can run the farm, they can keep it in the family, but they don't have to depend on it. So there's that tension there. So education is incredibly important. The cooperative has done a lot of work with coffee buyers to set up scholarship programs for the private cooperative school so that farmers' children can get what they feel is a better education than they would get in the public schools in the area. And so different coffee buyers provide scholarships. The school has an agreement with the cooperative that they offer a reduced tuition rate to the farmers. Not just in that cooperative, but in others as well.
So, but push that for us. So, yeah. What about those college graduates? I mean, if I have a limited amount of children, mm-hmm. you know, given Vivian's earlier question, if families are beginning to get smaller,
yeah.
my possibility of having a pool of kids who want to, in fact, inherit the farm goes
yeah.
down.
It does. However, the farms have been, over the centuries, have been subdivided so much that they're quite small. And so there isn't a lot of, it's part of an economic decision that even if you have three kids and you only have 2 or 3 hectares of land, it's almost not worth it to subdivide the land to between those children because it's too little for them to actually produce something. And so then they have to buy another piece of land which is very far away and work these different plots, and it's not very practical. So I think Some of the folks in the cooperative actually do have college educations, and then they choose to still continue on farming. They often are also then managers within the cooperative, mm-hmm. Which they earn a little bit of additional income, but not a large amount. So they studied the first president when I did my research, he studied in the seminary, decided that he didn't want to go down that route, had a family, and then became a coffee producer. And then the next one, Marcelo, who I mentioned, he studied agri-technical sciences. And so he actually had, agronomy. He had an agronomy background, which was really terrific in thinking through running the cooperative and what they needed and how to improve coffee quality and production. So I sort of answered a couple of different things. I don't know if I got to everything. And then you asked about the school day, and it doesn't change. There's morning and afternoon school in the city, and so you can choose if you want to go in the morning or the afternoon. So it's not like a full day, so they often can work either before school or after school and helping out.
Okay. Bill?
You mentioned that the fair trade farmers guarantee the price. Mm-hmm. How is that price set? And how does it compare to broader?
Yeah. So the fair trade price is set by the Fair Trade Labeling Organization. And that's set at a floor level as a minimum for everybody. And then what the farmers then do, and that's always, there's a premium on top of whatever the commodity price of coffee is. So let's say the commodity price of coffee, like it was several years ago, is really high at $2.50. And the fair trade premium is here at $1.40. It's always going to be 5 cents higher than the commodity price, at least. So then the farmers can earn additional money. And in fact, the folks at CoFAM do because of the quality of their coffee. They can earn $3 a pound or something like that because it's high quality. People want to buy it. So they're always going to have this floor with fair trade. And then they can earn more. And it's always going to be higher than the commodity price of coffee. However, your coffee has to meet the minimum quality standards to be there. So it's a little bit of a Folks sometimes think that they can produce, particularly people who are just starting, that they can just sell all their coffee for that. But if it doesn't meet the export requirements, if it's not high enough quality, no one will buy it. Now Brazil, unlike a lot of other countries, has a very strong internal coffee market. They consume, after the United States, they're the second large coffee consuming country in the world. So they can sell their coffee. They just don't earn quite as much money. So the coffee that's not good enough to export, they can sell.
Okay, Vivian?
Yeah, they are. This is a very water-rich area, fortunately for them. There's certainly, you know, it was rainforest, so there's certainly a lot of natural rainfall, so they don't irrigate their coffee. And there's a lot of groundwater as well, a lot of streams and springs. Mm-hmm.
Let me raise the issue that you began to talk about, subdividing of land.
Yeah.
You know, and you might remember in American history, this was a huge problem in what was called the enclosure movement, when people weren't allowed to move into unoccupied land.
Yeah.
And they kept on subdividing it for large families. Yeah. Can people actually acquire land to make their plots bigger? In effect, can I buy the neighbor's land, or can I buy other land? You mm-hmm. talked about
yeah.
that I can farm land that might yeah. be not contiguous with mine, but
right.
I might be able to acquire it
yeah.
elsewhere. How does that all work?
Somewhat similar to how it would work here. People post land for sale and you purchase it at whatever the market price is. So it is available, and people are always wanting to, a lot of the people even in the cities want to have a little farm, and so they buy a little bit of land and just kind of for fun. So it is available there. It's not a communal land structure or anything like that. It's sort of market driven, and you go to your real estate agent and buy your land.
So the co-op itself does not actually acquire
No.
land.
No.
And they've never gone that strategy.
No, they haven't.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Other questions, Bill?
I'm curious about something you said in your introduction. You said that Chelsea is a fair trade town.
Mm-hmm.
What does that mean?
Good question. So there's a movement for towns to become towns and universities and other towns, universities, and I think maybe one other, and I'm not remembering right now, to become fair trade towns or universities. And it's sort of, you go through these different steps where you have to have a certain number of businesses, like retailers, that are offering fair trade products. And it's dependent on the size of your city. So Chelsea's under 5,000 people, so we had to have two. And then it's institutions like hospitals or churches that are offering fair trade. And you have to, again, on the size of your population, meet that. And so it was two again. You have to have either a city resolution, or you have to go through a number of processes in trying to get a resolution, and we did get one in Chelsea that says the town will preferentially purchase, when available, fair trade products, like coffee, for example, and supports the town being a fair trade town. So those are three. You have to get media attention for the issue. So we got some attention from local newspapers and talked about why fair trade is important and why we wanted to be the first fair trade town in Michigan. And you have to have a team of volunteers who are willing to work on it. And so those are the five pieces you have to meet. And I think it's similar for universities. I actually haven't looked into it in detail. I suppose I could. I'm not local anymore, so I can't do the organizing here.
Now, does that affect, say, you try to make sure that all local coffee shops are actually using fair trade coffee in their coffee shops? I mean, does it have not only a buying component from
yeah.
a city point of view, but does it have a kind of a bully pulpit where you're really trying to get
yeah.
people locally to comply with that whole notion?
Yeah, you're encouraging it. I mean, there's no requirement. Chelsea the city was well on its way. It already had a 100% fair trade store. And a number of the coffee shops already offered fair trade coffee. So in the fair trade store and the folks who worked there, the board that I'm on, the nonprofit I'm on the board of, was associated with that store originally, and then we split off and that went for profit, and we kept with the advocacy. A lot of organizing and education has been going on for years on what fair trade is and why it's important, and then making the connection between local businesses, and everybody is very into buy local and support local, but global impacts and the fact that, you know, people want to buy coffee, it's not grown in Michigan, so, you know, let's get it from a local roaster that buys it from sustainable, you know, cooperatives or farms that are either organic or fair trade. So it was sort of over time, over quite a long period of time, in a small city, a lot of education about what fair trade is and why it has an impact and things like that.
Let me take you back to one thing that you mentioned, which was the alternative products that people work with in relation to kind of a home sustainability model. Mm-hmm. To what degree, you said that there were agronomists and others, I mean, a lot of the things that you're talking about on that list are synergistic. That is, yeah, that the reason that you have honey is because you really need bees, so that, yeah, bees actually fertilize the crops that you have.
Yep.
Right? And so maybe perhaps the same thing around pigs and manure, mm-hmm, or the specific crops that you might rotate on land. Mm-hmm. Are all of those things well known in terms of kind of the way that these families are looking at, mm-hmm, what they're putting together from an agricultural point of view?
I would say yes. The cooperative has done a tremendous job on educating farmers about sustainability, and they bring in experts to talk about soil quality. They use their price premium that they get for fair trade, the social development premium, to pay for workshops and lectures and people to come, and even to go on the farm and talk about what you can do. You know, oh, you can improve this by planting this plant along the side, and different things like that. You can conserve water by making sure you have some ground crops, so you're not just washing, or conserve water and soil that way. So they've focused on that, and a part of that again comes from the history of starting off with sort of this religious environmental group of folks who cared about that and felt that they were stewards of the earth. And then from there, they worked with some local nonprofits, NGOs, that were focused on the environment and sustainability. And then that's led into them seeking more and more opportunities to really be a strong organic producer. They were the first organic and fair trade coffee cooperative in Brazil, and now I believe there are two.
Okay.
So it's hard. Organic coffee production is not big in Brazil. This is, you know, they took the Green Revolution very seriously and use a lot of pesticides and a lot of herbicides in the conventional farming, and so this is kind of special, and I think that the history there with the fact that it came from a very dedicated group of people who felt it was rooted in their faith to be stewards of the earth is critical to the story.
Do they run into problems with bleed from other pesticides or herbicides that are used on neighboring farms in terms of effect on their farms?
So they try to protect as much as they can from pesticide drift with those barriers, mm-hmm, and that's something there can be some contamination that way, but the more you have in between your coffee field and the others is important, so you don't have pesticide drift, so it hits the banana trees or the sugar cane, mm-hmm, or whatever before it gets to your coffee. It's obviously a problem if you're, you know, these are basically planted on mountains. Thank you. If your farm is downhill from somebody, mm-hmm, using those things, the runoff is going to come onto your plantation. So you can't protect everything. You can just kind of do the best that you can. You cannot, if you produce both conventional and organic, you cannot have those two properties right next to each other. So you have to have, it can still be considered conventional, doesn't have to be certified, but you have to not use pesticides.
And how many of the farmers that you interviewed are a dual purpose in that fashion?
About 60% of the farmers are organic farmers, and have some organic production. Most of them have both. But they're fair trade. All their production is fair trade, so it's not conventional, so they're not using agrotoxics. And so they just aren't necessarily doing everything else you have to do to be organic.
Right, they're meeting.
I'm a farmer in that community, and I don't want anything to do with this fair trade thing.
Yeah.
Do you fly a prayer?
Oh, yeah. There are other cooperatives that are not fair trade, that are not organic, that you can sell to. They typically don't sell to the export market unless they're selling to like a big exporter that's making blend coffees or something like that. So you're not going to earn as much money, but you don't have to do as much work. So.
No one will dance with your daughter at the square dance. Social ostracism.
There's definitely both in the area. And people talk about it. It's really interesting to hear the farmers talk about like how I work in environmental health and toxics for my day job. And it's people talk about how a lot of reasons why they stick with this, even though it's more work, is they don't have to worry about their kids in the farm and going out there and just, you know, if it's a, you know, if they've got tomatoes growing in between, eating a tomato or eating a coffee cherry or anything like that. They don't have to worry about pesticides. They know their neighbors have, there's high rates of cancer in the area, and so they worry about that, and they're glad that they're not contributing to that, and they're hoping, you know, so they're very conscious of this. And I would say, from my reading on the literature of organic and fair trade, on the sort of environmental health side, the human health side, I would say more that so than others. It's a different chapter.
Well, I cannot thank you enough. What a wonderful presentation.
Thank you.
So thank you for coming and presenting today at our Daily Work, Our Daily Lives. See you all on Monday. Okay.
Thank you very much.